From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the Republican plan for dominance in the 21st century. We talk with LA Times White House correspondents Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston. Their new book, One Party Country, examines the structural changes and techniques that they say have tilted the playing field in favor of Republicans, including Karl Rove's political strategy of effectively putting the federal bureaucracy and the bully pulpit of the White House in service of GOP political goals. Also, we talk with the Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent Tom Ricks about what he's hearing from his sources about America's response to the war between Israel and Hezbollah. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Is the U.S. becoming a one-party country, a Republican country? That's the question asked in the new book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century, by Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston. They both cover the White House for the Los Angeles Times. They write that not only does the GOP control every part of every element of the federal government, Karl Rove has introduced a new political doctrine effectively putting the federal bureaucracy and the bully pulpit of the White House in service of long and short-term GOP political ends. Hamburger and Walston's book examines how the Republican Party put in place a series of structural and operational advantages that have given the Republicans the political edge and set the stage for what could become, at least for a time, a one-party country. One of the things you cover in your book is new campaigning techniques that Karl Rove and Ken Millman and others in the Republican Party help create. And you say that one of the strategies here is to master niche marketing and to take votes that had previously been considered block votes, you know, like the black vote, the Jewish vote, the labor vote, and to subdivide them, to take little bites out of them and make those into Republican votes. Can you talk a little bit more about this, like, niche marketing approach?
Sure. You know, many people make the mistake when they read stories about the Republicans going after the black vote or the Jewish vote that the goal might be to win a majority or a huge percentage of that group. That's never been the goal in this plan. Let's take the black vote as an example. In 2000, George Bush won 9% of the black vote nationally. In 2004, it was 11%. Not a very big jump. But in Ohio, that went up, we believe, from the polls we've seen, from 9% to 16%. And if you look at the raw numbers, that was the margin that George Bush needed to prevent another Florida-style recount in Ohio in 2004. And they do this by going after, they find sympathetic voters within these blocks. So one of my favorite anecdotes in the book speaking of the Jewish vote, was a rally on the final weekend of the 2004 campaign in Cleveland Heights, which has a huge population of Russian Jews. And they organized this rally in a party center there in Cleveland Heights, and they brought in all of the they brought in hundreds of Russian-speaking Jewish immigrants who were all American citizens and voters. And the rally was conducted entirely in Russian. And by the end of the rally, the entire crowd is standing up, chanting "Bush, Bush, Bush" in their Russian accents. And this, they brought in a White House official and some other Republican Party officials, and that added on to other efforts where they had gathered together lists of the Orthodox Jews in the neighborhood. The yeshivas gave girls the day off so they could babysit, so mothers could go out and vote. The local rebbes had instructed their congregants to vote. This is just one example of where they found a very small sliver of an electorate. You know, Jews overwhelmingly vote Democratic, but not Orthodox Jews, and these were Jews who cared a lot about what George Bush had done in Israel.
Why did the Republicans target Orthodox Jews, and why did they say Orthodox Jews as potential Republican votes?
These are religious conservatives, just in a similar, politically very similar to evangelical Christians. They have traditional views on life issues, and also in this case, they feel strongly for Israel, and terror, and they identified with the war on terrorism. They identified with the war in Iraq because they viewed Iraq as a threat to Israel. And this is a strategy where not only Orthodox Jews, but also conservative Jews, not politically, but religiously conservative Jews, were also courted heavily. And this was one area that in certain battleground states, you know, Florida has a huge Jewish population, Ohio, Michigan had a substantial Jewish population, and the Bush campaign did a lot to go after the Jewish community.
And in terms of targeting part of the African-American population, as you put it, you know, this kind of niche approach mm-hmm. to campaigning, what was the connection? Was it also through the churches that the Republicans targeted part of the African-American vote?
The churches played a huge role, Terry, in all of the niche outreach strategies that we talk about in the book. African-Americans, like Orthodox Jews, like evangelical Latinos, the Republican strategists believe, share a lot of the values agenda, as they call it, with the Republicans. So with that in mind, Republican strategists said, how can we go after the most reliable part of the Democratic Party base and win at least some of them over to the Republican Party? If we just win a fraction of the votes, it's okay. We don't need to win a majority because this is a closely divided nation. These elections are so close that the difference between 9 and 16 percentage points, say, in African-American turnout, can literally decide an election, which was the case in Ohio. And the Republican strategy was heavily targeted and built around outreach to African-American churches. And one of the things that strategists realized was that the churches, that African-American church, regular church-going African-American parishioners, are conservative on social issues, abortion, marriage, and a third, which we're seeing in the news just recently, is vouchers for schools and the right to attend private schools. That's something that resonates with church groups and religious groups, conservative groups, almost everywhere.
If I can add to that, another interesting scene in the book relates to a church in Milwaukee where one of the preachers in Milwaukee, the bishop of this particular church, endorsed President Bush in 2004 after years of supporting Democratic candidates for president. He did so for a lot of reasons, he says. One of the reasons we believe is that the White House successfully developed a relationship with him, and they did so in part through a program some of your listeners may know about, the White House Faith-Based Initiative. And this is an important point of the book, because one area that they're so effective at is mixing government and politics. More than any other administration in history, we believe. And the faith-based initiative involves taking taxpayer dollars, public money, and sending it to church-based social service organizations. Now, when this program was first introduced, of course, a lot of it began under the Clinton administration. President Clinton understood this form of outreach. But when George Bush first introduced this initiative, Democrats opposed it because they were worried about the separation of church and state. They thought it was a gift to the religious right. What a lot of people didn't realize at the time, and what Republicans did understand, at least the Bush White House did understand, was that this was a very effective way to reach black churches. And because if you go to these faith-based conferences, which the White House sponsors all over the country, the audiences are almost entirely black. It's full of black ministers, church activists, people who are really thankful that the government, that they feel that President Bush and his administration are trying to make federal dollars more available for their programs. They feel that they've been shut out over the years. So this particular bishop in Milwaukee received $1.5 million for his church. And he did endorse President Bush. The president visited his church at one point. He, like other black ministers from around the country, was brought to Washington and had several meetings in the White House with Karl Rove, also with the president. And this is an important part where the Bush campaign, the Bush administration, realized that these ministers are, as one of the president's advisors told us, the number one influencer in a community.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston. They're the authors of the new book, One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Hamburger and Walston both cover the White House for the Los Angeles Times. Now, you say in your book that although the Republican elections strategy is based on winning by narrow margins because they know it's a divided country. They know it's a divided country, so their approach is to have this kind of niche-style campaigning that you're talking about. But after they win office, in the White House in particular, you say they act as if they won by a landslide. And you write that in the Bush White House, tests of political purity were applied not just to those serving inside the administration, but to lawyers, lobbyists, and scores of others outside the government. So let's start with what you're saying here about tests of political purity applied inside the administration. Any more than typically happens in a presidential administration?
Yes, we found examples across the federal bureaucracy where the sort of bona fides of political appointees were tested very closely. It was particularly noteworthy in some of the scientific appointments at NIH, the FDA, and elsewhere, where candidates who would come in for interviews with the White House, sort of the penultimate moment before appointment or being named, they'd find that they were asked to explain campaign contributions they'd made even several years ago that happened to go to Democrats. We interviewed members of previous Democratic administrations, and were told that while there were, you know, political appointments, obviously are traditionally a place where you place your supporters, but that the kind of scientific, if you will, database testing of political loyalty is something new, and it's changed, and in a matter of degree. What also interested us was the way in which this sort of political loyalty was enforced to a degree we'd never seen before in the private sector as well, and here we're talking about the vast industry of K Street in Washington, where lobbying firms and trade associations would find that their appointments and their hiring practices were subject to review, not specifically and not directly from the White House, but from this burgeoning Republican machine, which has controlled hiring, not just in the executive branch, not just in the legislative branch, but now in the private sector as well. So you have a kind of loyalty test for the hiring of lobbyists in the private sector who will influence the government. And it set up a sort of new patronage system, if you will, for Republican loyalists. In other words, you work for a campaign, you make contributions, you even work a few years on Capitol Hill, and then as Republican activist Grover Norquist told us, there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. You can have a wonderful career path that takes you eventually to a six-figure salary in the private sector.
So are you saying that the Republicans basically have done a more effective job with the revolving door between government and private companies?
Oh, I think so. They have the number of lobbyists during the Republican era grew dramatically. It more than doubled, according to a Washington Post study, over the past 6 years, the number of registered lobbyists in Washington. And this happened in no small part because of a deliberate plan to make the lobbying world of Washington, the lobbying industry, a part of a new political machine. And we think that machine, which links K Street, Capitol Hill, the executive branch, and federal contracting, has become enormously powerful and explains, in no small part, the Republican success, which we document in this book.
And by the way, if I can also add to that, the downfall of Tom DeLay and questions about others involved in the K Street project, while that has been perhaps a bit of a setback in one sense, in another sense, our thesis, we maintain that this particular structural advantage and others remain in place and are continuing to have the impact of giving the Republican Party, again, that added advantage in elections.
My guests are Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston, authors of the new book, One Party Country. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston. They cover the White House for the LA Times. Their new book is called One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. When we left off, they were saying that candidates for political and bureaucratic positions virtually have to pass a Republican loyalty test. Okay, so you've described a system in which you think loyalty tests are basically administered in a way that they never were before, within the administration and within business as well. What impact do you think this is having on policy in America?
We think it's had an extraordinary impact. Every administration is political, of course. And as we acknowledge, every administration, every new president appoints his political friends and ideological soulmates to top positions. But what we found that was different under the Bush presidency is that the electoral imperatives and political influences extended deeper into the bureaucracy than we think has ever occurred before. A quick example that we cite in the book. The Bush administration, this administration, perhaps more than any other recently, has close friends in the energy industry and oil and natural gas. And one of the top priorities was to open up the western United States to oil and gas drilling. There is a vast bureaucracy that governs the federal lands of the West, and most of it based in the Interior Department, some at the EPA. Putting friendly people in charge of those agencies allowed this White House to direct the opening up of western lands for oil and gas exploration in a way we'd never seen before. One example, if I may, the Los Angeles Times discovered now about a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, the existence of a previously unknown White House task force. It was called the White House Task Force for Energy Permit Expediting. Now, I don't imagine your listeners have heard of it. Very few in Washington had heard of it before. But what this White House-based task force did was basically run over the top of the Bureau of Land Management, which grants permits for oil and gas drilling on public lands, and begin to ask or put pressure on the federal bureaucracy to grant these permits. We talked to one field archaeologist for the Bureau of Land Management who was being asked to quickly approve, who was reviewing a permit for a gas well in a remote part of a western state where there were some historical Indian artifacts on the land, and he was reviewing them to see whether those artifacts would be disturbed if oil and gas was permitted. And he got a call, he says, in his remote office in the West from someone who said they were from the White House Office of Energy Permit Expediting. And they asked about this specific permit that a major energy company was seeking. And he burst out laughing. He said, "You've got to be kidding me. You're the White House task force calling about a little old energy permit out here in the West. Don't you have a war in Iraq to be worrying about?" It turned out it was no joke. And he went on to say, if you get a call from the White House about a specific permit, which he had never seen before in his career, and he'd been with the BLM since the Carter administration, he said, you sit up and pay attention. And the bottom line, of course, was that we saw more than threefold increase in the number of permits that were granted for oil and gas drilling in western states just during the first term of the Bush administration alone.
You've investigated how Republicans have used new styles of campaigning, new approaches to computers and databanks and so on to get into office, and once in office have found ways of appointing people who are on the same page and rewarding them for it and kind of changing the whole nature of Washington in some way by having almost like loyalty tests within lobbies and so on. Do you think that this has led to something that's basically undemocratic in the sense that although Republicans have won in Washington by narrow margins, particularly in the White House, that Democrats have been kind of shut out of the dialogue?
Well, what these Republicans of today have realized is that when you win an election, you win. That gives you, if you have control of government, then you, they believe that you should use it to the fullest. Ken Melman has told us that you can campaign in a way to win a landslide victory, but that requires appealing to too many people. And this is a very closely divided nation, and technology has changed the way people think about issues. So that people have access to so much information now through the internet and other means that that people are going to, the country will be more closely divided than it has been in the past, he believes. And that the only way to actually push an ideological agenda, if you are a conservative and you want to push a conservative agenda, the only way to do that is to get your is to find your voters and get them to the polls. And that if you have a more benign campaign strategy where you, that might win you 60% of the vote, you're going to have to do that through a very kind of white bread strategy where you're going to both govern and campaign in a bland way. They don't want to do that. They want to push a certain agenda, and they want to be transformational in the way they change government, because they believe that government is a part of this machine. And so it's very important to them to find these voters and get them to the polls. And if that means just winning 51%, that's okay with them.
Part of your question implies, it seems to me, that if you win narrowly, you ought to reach out to the other side, govern from the middle. This administration, the Bush administration, chose very deliberately not to do that. They didn't govern from the middle. They, in effect, rewarded their conservative stalwarts who had been laboring in these think tanks and other organizations literally for decades. You could interpret that as anti-democratic, I suppose, Terry. But another way to look at it, which is I think the way the Republicans look at it, is that this is the nature of electoral politics.
Just to add to that, you asked about whether it's an undemocratic system. We might argue that it's undemocratic if you capitalize the word democratic. The Democratic Party right now isn't as much of a factor as they could be. If they also kind of harnessed the same technology and had the same resources and kind of built the same machine. So this is an area that, you know, the Republican Party far surpasses the Democratic Party in the tactics of politics, and that gives the Republican Party the ability to enact its vision in government.
Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston cover the White House for the LA Times. Their new book is called One Party Country. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Grover Norquist's Wednesday meetings and how they help keep conservatives on the same page. We continue our conversation with Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston. Also, The Washington Post senior Pentagon correspondent Tom Ricks tells us what he's hearing from sources about the American response to the war between Israel and Hezbollah. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston. They both cover the White House for the LA Times. They've written a new book called One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. The book analyzes how Republicans have come to control every part of the federal government and how they plan to maintain that control. Now, one of the things that you write about is something called the Wednesday meeting, or is it the Wednesday morning meeting?
The Wednesday meeting.
Yes, and this is a now famous meeting, run by Grover Norquist, who, among the other things, is the founders for Americans for Tax Reform, a group that basically believes taxes are bad. Period. I've heard a lot about this meeting. I can't say I've ever completely understood like how it works or what its impact has been. So, why don't you describe what these meetings are and why they've been so important?
We were able, in the course of writing the book, we did get access to about a dozen of the Wednesday meetings that Grover Norquist runs every Wednesday morning from his office on L Street, the Office of Americans for Tax Reform. The leaders of the conservative movement stream into a conference room. It's not just the leaders of organizations like the American Conservative Union or Phyllis Schlafly and the and her organization, the Heritage Foundation, or other sort of well-known organizations in Washington. It's also frumpy job seekers just out of college looking for jobs in Washington. It's activists for causes that run the full range of conservative interests, from those who are campaigning for a stronger defense and even a bigger defense budget to those who seek the elimination, for example, of federal funding for schools. These groups with varied interests come together. And I might add, it's important to add, that in addition to those conservative ideological groups who are in attendance, we also have K Street, the corporate community, represented as well. And these are not just lobbyists. The lobbyists are not household names, but the companies they represent, Verizon, Microsoft, major defense contractors, are very well known. These groups, these folks come together, usually it's between 100 and 200 people, sometimes more than that, to discuss conservative issues, to discuss the news of the day and a conservative response to them. The meetings start usually with Grover Norquist, who is this diminutive, kind of rumpled, red-faced guy, who comes in and introduces the session. And usually there is often a prominent guest who's there, a cabinet member, sometimes a couple of cabinet members, who will speak to a current issue. One time, Karl Rove attends a couple of times a year. Every week, someone from Karl Rove's office is in attendance and usually gives a report from the White House on what's coming up that week. What's remarkable is the range of interests that are represented in the room. This is the conservative coalition, and in some ways being in this room tells you why conservatives have succeeded so well.
What does it tell you?
It shows you how groups with seemingly diverse interests are able to come together and unite in common political cause. Let me give you one example. Norquist described an effort in the 1990s to fight fuel efficiency standards. He was inspired to do this, he says, by his own libertarian instincts. He doesn't like government regulation. Of course, he had support from some of his benefactors, the automobile industry, who didn't want new fuel efficiency standards imposed on cars. And he says that he brought Phyllis Schlafly of the Conservative Eagle Forum along with him by explaining that if the federal government were to succeed in forcing Americans into tinier, fuel-efficient cars, it would, in effect, be a form of de facto family planning. And he says, Phyllis responded, "You're right, and I hate those cars." Suddenly, Norquist had one of his now rather famous alliances. Not only was it the automobile industry, conservative libertarians who opposed regulation, but also the Eagle Forum, the moral majority, backing an effort to halt fuel efficiency standards.
Can I offer another scene that we witnessed in a Wednesday meeting that also, I think, said a lot about the power of the conservative movement? Shortly after President Bush nominated Harriet Myers to be Supreme Court justice, the conservative movement was outraged. This is a room full of conservative intellectuals and opinion leaders who really viewed the Supreme Court as the crown jewel of what they were after in this era of Republican dominance, and that was the ability to appoint Supreme Court justices who would be true conservatives. Harriet Myers suddenly was somebody who was not a part of their movement. She was not necessarily a true conservative. They really didn't know what she was other than a close friend of President Bush. And this is where a rebellion happened. And the White House actually sent Ed Gillespie, who was a former chairman of the Republican Party and who had been they had temporarily appointed to help shepherd Harriet Meyer's nomination. And he really took it on the chin in that meeting. And people really yelled at him. And it was an indication to us that this nomination was not going to survive because the movement was so powerful. And the White House really relies on them. And one of the purposes of this Wednesday meeting is so that the White House can rely on these people to go out and spread the message. They have access to conservative talk radio, to the media, to their think tanks, to academic institutions, to their organizations that have mailing lists and email lists of thousands and thousands of people. The White House was going to rely on this movement to help guide Harriet Meyer's nomination, and yet they really objected to it. And that was really an early indication that, that her nomination was going to go nowhere. And of course, she was with her nomination was she withdrew her nomination, and the movement was quite pleased that they ultimately did win conservatives on the court.
So one of the functions of these Wednesday meetings are to basically set the agenda, come up with the talking points, and get people from diverse groups on the same page.
Yes, and it's one area, of, we believe, of stark contrast to the liberal movement, which has begun their own efforts to try to corral the different interests of the Democratic Party and the liberal movement in a similar meeting, but are very far from having this kind of success because, as you know, the environmentalists don't always get along with the labor unions, and they're always you know, the gay rights movement wants one thing, but other people don't, other liberals don't want that their agenda to be the overarching agenda. Whereas in Grover's Wednesday meeting, you get a sense for how people are able to put tactics and the kind of broader vision of a conservative ruling majority over their kind of perhaps more parochial interests. And there have been liberals who have gone to that meeting and who speak admiringly of its impact, including Donna Brazile and the man whose presidential campaign she managed, Al Gore, who actually went to one meeting and lingered for quite a while.
My guests are L.A. Times reporters Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston, authors of the new book One Party Country. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston. They both cover the White House for the L.A. Times, and they've written a new book called One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Just curious, having written this book about how successful the Republican Party has been in moving the country, in moving the government to the right, you hear a lot of conservatives complaining about how liberal the media is. And, you know, on like Bill O'Reilly, for example, has often pointed to your paper, the LA Times, as being a perfect example of the liberal bias of the media. So how do you react to that?
Well, we're accustomed to the complaints of liberal bias. And in fact, one of the things we'd argue, we don't go into it in great depth in the book, but it's one of the things that we believe, is that the targeting of the mainstream, even establishment media, if you will, of which I think the LA Times is a part, and so is the New York Times, and so are most mass circulation daily newspapers, as having a liberal bias has been one of the most successful campaigns, and it's been an organized campaign, of the conservative right. And it's made editors and reporters cautious about what they say. Not only that, it's led to a transformation in the nature of the media, such that today, at least I'd make the argument that it's conservative commentators, it's shows like Bill O'Reilly that actually dominate the airwaves. The how many prominent Democratic talk show hosts can we name? There just aren't that many. It's Republicans who seem to dominate, and it's Fox News, which broadcasts under the moniker Fair and Balanced, that is leading the ratings.
So do you think that, are you saying that you think that papers like the LA Times are intimidated by the charges that the press is liberal and that they've been changing policy as a result? Because you said this has been a very successful campaign.
Well, it's been successful in terms of the way that they managed to vilify the media as liberal, but no, and I wouldn't argue that the LA Times or the New York Times, to the extent that I see it from the outside, is intimidated. There's been a lot of solid investigative work done on this administration, and as there have been on other Democratic administrations. So in that sense, we don't see it at the LA Times anyway that there's been any intimidation, but it does. Change. It affects the way that we talk about stories in the newsroom. We're covering the conservative movement, and we know that we're open to scrutiny. But you know, the scrutiny comes from both sides, and I think I probably speak for both of us when I say that that I get hate mail from both sides, and the liberal bloggers are just as convinced that we're lapdogs to the Republicans as the Republicans are convinced that we're representatives of the liberal media. So perhaps that means we're doing something right if we're taking it from both sides. But
I have a slightly different view, which is that in the period, at least over the longer term, over the period, particularly post 9/11, I think that there was a noticeable diminution in the aggressiveness of the press corps nationally. I think that there has been a realization on the part of editors and a sensitivity to the complaint of liberal bias and a more aggressive effort not to suppress stories but to provide more balance both on editorial pages and to be sure that all points of view are represented. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but I do think it's a consequence of this pressure. I think also that is starting to change, and you're seeing the press corps in the last couple of years find its footing again and return to a more activist watchdog role.
Peter, I have a question for you, and this is Peter Walston here. It was you who was wearing sunglasses at a press conference with the president, and you asked a question, and the president said, "Are you going to ask that question with shades on?" And what did you say?
I offered to take my sunglasses off. He said, "No, that's okay. You can leave them on." Of course, this was in the Rose Garden. It was outside. He said, "No, I like the shades look." So I left them on and I asked my question. But he said, he did point out that it wasn't sunny, at least to the viewers on TV. And I told him that it depends on your perspective.
And tell us why you were wearing the sunglasses.
I have an eye condition, a retinal condition. It's called Stargardt's disease. It's a form of macular degeneration, which has taken away most of my central vision. But in that context, I was wearing sunglasses because even though it was a cloudy day, I'm very sensitive to glare, and there was a lot of glare in the Rose Garden. So we were, you know, when you're sitting outside for a couple hours, it can get to be pretty painful. So I keep my sunglasses on outside.
So the president called you on your cell phone to apologize. Has this changed your relationship in any way? I don't know if you've had, you know, any kind of direct contact with the president outside of attending press conferences, but
I don't think so. I really hope that it hasn't. It didn't bother me at the time. It bothered other people. Like, I guess I didn't realize it was such a big deal until I got back to my office from the press conference and started reading what was going on the internet, the discussion online. A lot of my friends around town know about my condition. I don't advertise it, and I certainly never told the White House or certainly not the president. It's just not how I want to be known or identified. So I didn't. It just didn't bother me, and I thought it was funny. And he, you know, that same day he made fun of someone else's name. He made fun of another reporter for what he was wearing. I mean, that's just. I think it's a tactic to try to disarm reporters and get knock them off stride and maybe get them to ask an easier question. He certainly didn't know it. He didn't mean it personally. I was almost embarrassed when he called me to apologize. I just didn't want it to get to that level.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Hamburger and Peter Walston cover the White House for the LA Times. Their new book is called One Party Country. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tom Ricks, the Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent, has a new book called Fiasco, The American Military Misadventure in Iraq. We'll talk about the book tomorrow on Fresh Air. Earlier today, I asked him what he's hearing from his sources about the American response to the war between Israel and Hezbollah. Tom Ricks, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm wondering if you think that it is any more likely that the U.S. will have a military strike against Iran. There's like three different reasons why the U.S. might be considering that, three reasons I'm aware of. One is the nuclear option that Iran seems to be developing. The other is that Iran backs Hezbollah. And the third is that General George Casey said that the Iranians appear to be backing extremist Shia in Iraq by providing weapons, IED technology, and training, and that, in fact, they're doing some of that training in Iran. So does it look like a U.S. military strike against Iran is becoming more likely?
I don't think so. I think for the reasons you lay out, that the Bush administration is growing increasingly unhappy with Iran. The problem is the more the United States talks about a military option, the more it scares our allies, who we need in order to have a solid diplomatic front in dealing with Iran. And so I think the United States has kind of backed off talking about a military option for Iran. But it's the Middle East, and anything can happen.
Is this controversial within the administration? Are there people taking sides within the administration or the military?
Yeah, I think inside the military, there's a lot of unhappiness with the idea of going after Iran militarily. Iran is a very big, very powerful, and relatively rich country in the Middle East. It would be a much more difficult operation than even Iraq has been. And people talk about just doing airstrikes, but it's not clear what that would lead to. Air power alone generally has not been an effective use of military force.
Now, I read that there was an Israeli memo that was leaked of a contingency plan for attacking Iran on its own if the U.S. doesn't. What do you know about that?
There was talk of this a few months ago. I actually read a U.S. military study of that option. It would be enormously difficult to carry out without some sort of nod and a wink from the United States, because in order to get to Iran, you'd have to fly Israeli aircraft either across Iraq, where the United States clearly would know they were there, or the whole way across Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia likely would not welcome that. And so I think it would be very hard to do that for the Israelis without the Americans giving them a green light. And so it almost would be like the United States doing it. People in the Middle East would blame the United States for allowing it to happen.
What have you heard from your sources in the Pentagon about our strategy, the U.S. strategy in the Middle East now in the war between Israel and Hezbollah?
What I'm hearing broadly from defense experts lately in the military, retired military strategy experts, is a real broad unhappiness with the situation. These are guys who have spent 20 or 30 years steeped in these issues, and their general attitude seems to be, I don't know about you, but I'm heading down for the basement and waiting for the storm to blow over. But I think that misses one basic aspect of the Bush administration's approach to the Middle East. And it was captured best by Paul Wolfowitz when he was at the Pentagon. He said to me one day, if you liked 9/11, then keep up the policy of containment, keep up the policy of stability. And this is where the Bush administration several years ago split with the so-called realpolitik, or the realist. It does not have the ambition of having stability in the Middle East. In many ways, it has sided with instability. It's rolled the dice. It said, let's change the dynamics. Let's change the politics of the Middle East. This is captured in the phrase you heard a lot a couple of years ago, let's drain the swamp. So we kind of rolled the dice in Iraq, and we're allowing the Israelis to roll the dice right now against Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it's a very bumpy ride for us. It's a much more dynamic situation than it used to be. But we have allied ourselves with the forces of radical change in the Middle East. And it'll be interesting to see the response from the radicals on the other side.
Well, you know, in your book about Iraq, Fiasco, you describe the Bush administration as brinksmen. Do you think they still are brinksmen after all the problems they've run into in Iraq?
I think they still have the brinkish impulse, if you will. but we are realizing that politically it's a lot harder to carry off now, partly because they enjoyed the benefit of the doubt after 9/11 and after a successful invasion of Afghanistan. And they were saying the rules of war have changed. This is going to be different. Well, now the rules of war have reasserted themselves against the U.S. presence in Iraq. And I think they've gotten their nose bloodied a bit. And it's harder to bring along the Republican Party, let alone the Democrats.
My guest is Tom Ricks, senior Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Ricks, The Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent. We're discussing what he's hearing from sources about the American response to the war between Israel and Hezbollah. Now, I read that American officials don't expect the U.S. to participate in an international peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon, if there is one. Is that because we're stretched so thin in Iraq, or is that because of other reasons?
I think it's for both. I think it's very easy for the United States to say, great idea, fellas, but we're tapped out at the moment. We don't have any troops available on the shelf for you. I think the second unspoken reason for the U.S. not participating in a peacekeeping force in Lebanon is they don't think it's going to work. If it does get put together, the force will be ineffective and unable to militarily confront Hezbollah, and it will be attacked by Hezbollah, and it will be seen as an occupation force, no matter what the impulse is in putting it together. So I think they're saying, let's just take a pass on this. Let them try to put it together. You know, the Turkish government might lead it, or the French military might lead it, but we'll applaud from the sidelines on this one.
In your book about the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq, you write that the U.S. experience in Iraq may come to resemble Israel's painful occupation of parts of southern Lebanon. And you were there referring to Israel's 1982 invasion and its subsequent occupation. But I'm wondering if you think that Israel has, in a way, taken a page out of the Iraq playbook in its strategy in dealing with Hezbollah through an air campaign.
That's a good question. What I don't understand about what's going on now with Israel is I don't see how they can achieve militarily the objective they've stated if they only use air power. They've said they wanted to extirpate Hezbollah, to break it as a military power. And ultimately, the only way you can do that is by putting your young men and women on the ground, in the mud, and having them slug it out. You cannot do this from the air. And so I think what you're seeing now is a lot of light infantry movement in an attempt to capture major Hezbollah leaders, to destroy their best fighting forces, but not putting in a big armored thrust because they don't want to just drive away Hezbollah. They want to destroy them. And I think you'll see a couple of weeks of this sort of raid and sniping, and then maybe more movement on the ground when they feel they've broken the major Hezbollah units.
What else do you see when you look in the near future in the confrontations between Israel and Hezbollah?
I see a lot of people who I really trust on strategic matters wondering whether Israel knows what it's doing, what Israel really hopes to achieve here. Their stated objective of breaking and destroying Hezbollah is likely not going to happen. Even if they get all these 12,000 Katusha-style rockets, which are fairly short-range rockets, it's already been proven that Hezbollah has larger rockets available to it and simply can fire them from further back in Lebanon. So what do you do then? Invade northern Lebanon? So it's not clear to me strategically how Israel could achieve the outcome it has stated it wants to achieve through this operation.
Do you have sources in the Pentagon who are worried about what the war between Israel and Hezbollah will mean for the future of the United States and its military?
Well, in broad terms, yes. The real concern for the United States and Iraq right now is, will that war spread across Iraq's borders? And some people think effectively it already has, that what you have with Hezbollah is an attack by a proxy of Iran on Israel, a proxy of the United States. So effectively, they see this as simply another front in this same confrontation. Other people disagree with that. But regionalization of either war could be a terrible thing in the Middle East. You may see it's possible, I'm not saying it's going to happen, a broader Middle East war. And once that happens, that has global consequences. Most immediately and selfishly for us, it likely would send the price of oil spiraling. And that would have economic repercussions for us and for every other country in the world. You could see fighting break out on another front. One thing that worries me right now is the Turks are very unhappy with some of the Kurds in northern Iraq and have basically threatened to invade northern Iraq to go after some of the Kurdish elements there. So there's a possibility you could see a couple more fronts open in the current fighting.
Well, Tom Ricks, thank you for talking with us. We'll talk more tomorrow about your new book on the invasion and occupation of Iraq, and the title of that book is Fiasco, so that will give our listeners some idea of the conversation we'll have tomorrow. Tom Ricks, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Ricks is the Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent, and as I said, tomorrow we'll talk with him about his book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from pianist Billy Taylor. Today is his 85th birthday. This is his best-known composition, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Lily's Ghost, a novel about a mother's love and the traumas of war, by Cheryl Drake Harris. From Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology, capella.edu. And from BMW, where ideas are everything, and as an independent company, they have the freedom to let those ideas live on. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In his new book, Fiasco, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tom Ricks tells the inside story of what went wrong with the American invasion of Iraq and what he describes as our agonizingly incompetent occupation. Ricks is the Washington Post's senior Pentagon correspondent. Join us for the next Fresh Air.